Welcome to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, your casual history connoisseur, and my co-host is Eric Mason, our brilliant loose cannon economist who brings a wealth of knowledge and the wildest historical facts to the table. Now, this is a big project, but we're going to do it right, and we're going to start at the very beginning with our first and reluctant president, George Washington. Eric, you want to kind of kick us off with a little bit of backstory?
Oh, absolutely, Kyle. And when Kyle and I first started discussing this in Lara, it was about, you know, there are millions of different history podcasts. There are a million different really, really good narrators and orators who can walk you through the history of the presidents. All right. It's a very rich field. It's good that we know about these men who led our country. I think we're getting a little different is that we're going to be applying not just historical stories, not just the funny stuff or joke around a lot, because it is interesting. We're applying something called cleometrics, and that's when you mix in a little economics with your history. So we're not just going to look at what happened. We're going to use economics to understand why those decisions were made, and we're going to laugh about it a little bit because American history is wild, and we're going to have a lot of fun. We're going to try to do pretty much every president up until the year 2000. Hopefully you'll stick along that journey with us. We're going to go off on tangents. We're going to talk about John Hancock. I'm still petitioning Kyle to let me do Jefferson Davis, because
I've already wrote it in. Okay, we're doing that.
Because I don't think most Americans know that the president of the Confederate States of America became an insurance salesman after the war was over. I think that's ripe with jokes. We're going to have guests along the way. Kyle's already arranged for our dear Canadian friend to join us to awkwardly talk about the time the Canadians burnt down the White House. And we're going to have some great guests, I think, along the way, too.
Yep.
Kyle, anything? What did I miss?
For me, I've always been interested in history, but I've never really spent a whole lot of time, like, diving into the American presidents, like what we were planning on doing here. So for me, this is exciting to get to see what was life like for the people during those terms, and how do those policies affect, like, the everyday lives of those people. So applying the cleometrics to it is kind of what sold me on this whole project. Because like you said, this has been done how many times before? But then you throw in the flavor of some of the stories that you're going to be telling, and I've seen a sneak peek of a couple of them, and I think you're going to blow some minds.
Yeah, you're not, I mean, we'll cover George Washington first, but right off the bat, we got fellow Quincy native John Adams, and that will be my favorite recording of all time, if anything, because I want to really convince everybody that John Adams should be considered the best president of the first 10.
Yep. And then we'll follow that up with the worst of the first 10.
Yes, Eric is not, history's not a huge fan of. As Kyle said, we were doing this right. We're doing our research and our homework, but we are going to start with a prepared response. Otherwise, it's going to be mostly off the cuff.
Yes. This is the most professional this podcast will ever sound.
Washington's journey to the top came with zero party backing and zero patience for political drama. Yet he somehow held together a nation that was just itching to fall apart. From his early days charting land in Virginia to his battlefield heroics in the Revolutionary War, Washington wasn't just another figurehead. He was a hands-on leader with a vision. We'll break down how the straight-laced general set up some of our nation's most important traditions, like a cabinet of advisors to share the load, a no-nonsense foreign policy stance, and the ultimate power move, stepping down after only two terms. His presidency brought clashes, especially when he had to shut down the risky rebellion with a little muscle, reminding the nation of who's boss. Then there's his softer side with Martha, America's first lady, who brought grace and diplomacy to the White House while he ran the show. And don't think Washington's legacy stopped when he left the White House. He returned to Mount Vernon, very much like his idol Cincinnatus, a man obsessed with his land and legacy. Proved he wasn't about endless power, but about building something bigger. When he finally left this earth at age 67, he left a country with a roadmap for a presidency and a legend that's still bigger than he was and bigger than life.
Stick with us, because we're going to get the scoop on Washington's policies, precedents, and the stories that they never taught you in high school. Remember to follow The Buck Starts Here, where we're going to unpack the drama, decisions, and yes, the bucks of every president's time in office.
So, Kyle, are you ready to go? You want to start this show, buddy?
Well, I mean, okay, you said you want to start with his life, so, tell me about Washington's childhood or upbringing, or however far back you want to go.
So I think we should start with his early life, because I think Washington, I think he's become such a big figure, you know, in American culture, that we forget that he was a person, right? Like, he was born.
Yeah.
He had a life, and those decisions he made put him in a position to become the father of our country.
Yeah.
Yeah, so George Washington, was born in 1732, which by the time of the Revolution, it pretty much made, you know, him and Franklin being kind of the oldest guys in the room. One of the weird parts about the American Revolution is we tend to think it was old people doing it. They were all young. I mean, Washington and Franklin were older, and so was Adams at the time. But, like, Madison was, like, 19. Jefferson was on the younger side, too.
Is that just because everyone wore wigs at the time? Like, it just made them look older in, like, their portraits, maybe?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah,
or all the images that we have of them, like, once they've been more distinguished. Like, nobody's taking photos, like, during the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Nobody's taking, yeah, exactly. First president ever photographed John Quincy Adams. But, no, exactly. So it was that a lot of the ways we look at the past at that time point would just naturally associate them with being older, right? I mean, the powdered wigs, you know, syphilis isn't running around anymore, so people aren't wearing powdered wigs. So,
as much.
As much, yeah. So yeah, just everybody's aware that's why powdered wigs became in vogue.
Thank you, Louis.
Yeah, thank you, Louis. But yeah, so he was, you know, so he was, obviously we all know he was born in Virginia in 1732, which was about as close to being born. If you had to compare it to a modern day area, it's like being born in, like, probably Nepal would be a good terms of population density and lack of institutional development. Like, you know, it is amazing that somebody who became so influential in the founding of a country that, you know, to steal the Margaret Thatcher quote, Europe was founded on history, the U.S. is founded on philosophy. And we look at a lot of these founding fathers as, well, I mean, some of them certainly would qualify as philosophers. I mean, certainly Thomas Paine would. But we basically look at them as philosopher politicians. And to have somebody like Washington, who was born, you know, on a small farm, who, you know, didn't have much growing up, in a time when the United States wasn't developing, it wasn't like, you know, the post-trade booms you saw like in the 1750s and 60s. It is amazing to think that this man came to embody so much of the American psyche and philosophy that exists to today. And he was a man who was born in the backwoods.
Right. Well, you mentioned that, but when we were talking about the planning, and at one point you mentioned just the fabulous wealth of the colonies at the time relative to, like, the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So how did, like, his upbringing compared to, like, what's going on over across the pond in, like, Europe, England.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, yeah, he probably would prefer, if you had to choose, to live in London in the 1730s and 40s right. or live in Virginia. He'd probably pick Virginia just because of the lack of disease and pollution. You know, it is important to note there was still a lot of wealth in the colonies, but that was mostly concentrated in New England.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a lot of trading. You had the triangle trade, you know, obviously. You know, we have to be honest with our history, right? Like, the triangle trade was largely supported slavery in the Caribbean, and George Washington had his family owned slaves, and he had slaves most of his life. You know, that's obviously a much more serious and different discussion, I think, kind of the lighthearted history survey that this show will be. But
right, but we're still going to ding him for that.
Yeah, right. We're still going to acknowledge it, because as much as we just want to, like, you know, give people a good product where they talk about, make some economics in with their history and talk about the presidents, you know, there's still things that happened and they have to be acknowledged. Otherwise, you're bound to repeat your past, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't from this elite Virginia family. Now, if you were an elite Virginian at that time, you lived a good life. Like, you probably didn't have access to the array of goods that, say, a nobleman living in England or France did at the time. But you were living way better than the average average person in England.
Mm-hmm.
So funny thing, a lot of, like, this time period in history is really funny because it's about as far back as we can go with records that can be used for data analysis. Use like 1790s, kind of the lower end.
Right.
One of the ways we know people existed is because of their credit at stores. So, like,
that makes sense.
So there's many founding fathers who will be like, we'll have records of them, especially, like, not like the huge founding fathers like the Adamses and the Washingtons and the Jeffersons, but like that tier right below them. And we're like, oh, we want to know more about their lives. So we'll read up on, like, the store, the local town store, we'll go look for their records. And they'll be like, oh, there's like two different women buying lingerie on this dude's credit card, this dude's line of credit. He wasn't married. And it's like,
good to know that still existed.
Yeah. I just like that this dude, like, But yeah, it is absolutely fascinating. I mean, that he had such little formal education too. Horace Mann didn't exist yet. Francis Parker wasn't around yet. There wasn't this standardization of education that would come to define the Western world, within 100 years. But it is funny because Washington had, Kyle, you probably know the story, but the story of Cincinnatus, he was a Roman citizen, Roman general, who was a farmer. And he was called upon when Rome was invaded, and he became a dictator. Because that's, back then, that the word dictator had like the autocratic connotation it does today.
Right.
And he defeated Rome's enemies, and then he went back to his farm. He gave up power. And from a young age, Washington was kind of like obsessed with this story. And it's amazing to see that story arc where he became the American Cincinnatus. He could have been king.
And he, right,
just like the interest that he just went and sat down afterwards, just was like, I'm done.
That is pretty impressive. But like, even being elected as president, sound like he didn't even really want to do that either. Like, how did they manage to convince him then?
Yeah, it took a lot of convincing. It took him a lot of convincing to, you know, he wanted, like, listen, he definitely wanted to be the, you know, the effectively the supreme commander of the revolutionary forces. Don't get me wrong there. But to be president took a lot of convincing. And it's important to remember that it wasn't the end of the revolution that his presidency. The time frame difference was pretty long. I mean, he got elected in 1788. That was 12 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
I know.
Yeah, we had a lot of rough times in between there, between the Articles of Confederation, you know, just trying to figure out who we are as a country. And one of the big reasons that after the Constitutional Conventions and adopting the Constitution of the United States, that, you know, still exists today, longest still active constitution in the world, there was a lot of people that convinced him to run. John Adams, who he was very, very close with, was like, you're the guy, was pretty much like, you're the guy. You're... Mm-hmm. It's because of the apoliticalness. It's because he's a Virginian, but he's a Virginian who believes in the national and the federal government. At this time, southern states were very pro state rights, where northern states were more unionist. And I think those are two words that are probably going to come around maybe in about 70 years, in about 40.
Right.
But, nice. Yeah, it's funny. He had an interesting childhood. So he was, his dad died young. I don't know if the historic record fully knows what he died of. I try to do a little more homework on this, and it is funny. You do get different answers of what happened to his father. But he and his mom ended up remarrying. And so he had a half-brother, Lawrence, who he was like obsessed with. And they were very...
I never remember hearing about a brother.
Yeah, so it's funny. Nobody ever... Huh. I've brought this up before with, you know, discussing this, and I'm like, yeah, the reason he wanted to become a general was his brother. His brother was in the British Army. He looked up to his half-brother, Lawrence, and was like, you know, I'm a little brother. I look up to my brother. Like, you want to be like... Right. I'm very, very lanky and tall, and I remember first day of freshman year playing football, and they said, what position do you want to play? And I was like, oh, I want to play left tackle. And the coach just like stared at me because I am built like a string bean. But my brother is a like big dude. Like he looked like a tackle. And I was like, whoa, but I want to do what my brother did, right? And I love that. That's how George Washington got into the military. Like, he was like, oh, my brother's a guy I look up to does this, so like, I'm gonna go be a general. dude, people don't change. They don't change.
Well, he didn't really follow too closely because his brother, it sounds like you said, was in the British side.
Oh, Kyle, yes, that is true, but this is early, this is, you know, 1750s, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So George Washington joined the British Army, following after his brother. And, all right, quick tangent here, because we've all heard this story in high school, right, that, oh, George Washington founded Fort Necessity in the French and Indian War, blah, 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 and then, like, he had to surrender, and, oh, it was a big stain, and George Washington was angry his whole life that he signed the surrender in French, so he didn't understand what it meant. George Washington was 22 when that happened.
Right.
22 years old.
Dude, that's ancient by 1740s standards.
Adjusting for inflation, that's at least 55, Eric. So I want to give him a little more, like, yeah, make him feel a little better about making, like, I feel like a 22-year-old leading, like, a I think it was a company of troops. That's impressive. And like, what he got, I wouldn't have built the fort in the middle of a valley.
Right.
That seemed bad. Like, I've only read one book by Sun Tzu, but I'm pretty sure we all knew, like, don't build the fort in the valley. would I have done it at 22? Maybe. So, like, I want to give credit.
I mean, was it his own actions, or was he following orders?
No, they were pretty independent at this time. Yeah. That's a good question. Kyle, veteran, who probably has been told to do things, that he was like, this seems stupid.
A few times, yes.
I recently learned that Kyle's dryer in his submarine used to catch on fire. And that's terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, about once a patrol, I think. You'd smell smoke.
That's... Hope we address that. Well, let's talk about George Washington's military. so he had this thing where he always wanted to be a great leader in the military. And he was a big believer in the British military. Like, he wasn't like a Sam Adams. He wasn't like, he was more of a military version of John Adams, right? John Adams did the, he defended the Brits in the Boston Massacre.
Right, yeah, yep.
Like, law and order, law and order, law and order kind of guy. So was George Washington. I think that's why Adams and Washington got along so well. But he really believed that, like, he could rise up in class. I don't want to say he was obsessed with his status. He wasn't. There's no, people like to editorialize that, I think, for the sake of a good story. One of the things Kyle and I aren't going to do throughout this show is editorialize stuff just to make a story sound better. Like, that's, I don't believe in that.
No, the facts are impressive on their own, I think.
Yeah, he was just this guy who wanted to climb up. He wanted to, you know, better himself. And he, like a lot of people even today, saw military service as a way to do that. And he saw all these opportunities, but at the time, the British military, it wasn't a meritocracy, right? It was, you basically bought your rank. I mean, which is very ironic because the reason Washington couldn't climb was because of that, like, nobleman having to buy your way in. And the reason that a lot of people think that the Brits lost the Revolutionary War is because Cromwell pretty much was, like, bought his way into that position.
Right.
And then got his teeth kicked in by a bunch of, like, colonialists.
Well, see, I've been thinking a lot about that. And I was actually wondering how much of it has to do with just the delays in, like, supply chains and communications. Like, when you stick somebody out on, you know, campaign, like, he's pretty much on his own. It takes, what, months to get orders dispatched back to London?
Yeah, so that's a good point. I mean, that's why you also saw generals at that time period serving so far forward.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically like it wasn't just the Brits, but the Brits, the French, all of them, they would pretty much, like, send generals and admirals far forward with a very broad objective and let the general figure it out. It is ironic that it still took them, like, 100 years to see the value of the NCO Corps. What do you mean, taking an expert and telling him and asking him broadly to complete an objective is better than me, a king, telling people how to do things that I've never done before? Who would have ever thought that?
It's not like, thought?
Yeah. Thought that the largest country on earth would be tied down in a war right now? No NCO Corps. history doesn't change. History does not change. Yeah, so Washington, you know, he was trying to kind of figure out his life. He obviously wanted to be in the military, but at that time, you know, there was a regular military. There was the Redcoats, don't get me wrong, but the vast majority of military fighting was still irregulars.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'd call them militias modern day, but no, I think we'd probably call it irregulars more like a reservist today.
Yeah, that sounds more apt.
Kyle, what's the thing, when you get out of the service, is it IRR, like the individual ready reserve or something like that you have to do?
It was inactive reserves, I think is what they called it. Yeah. So it was like 2 years. You had to do a total of 8 years total service. So I served for 6, and then there was 2 years of inactive reserves where they could call me up, but I didn't have to check in or anything. I didn't have to go to report to posts or any of that stuff.
Yeah, but you still
have to... Whereas if you're an officer, it's the other way. I think they can call you back anytime they want.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So, but you... If I remember correctly, and Kyle, please correct me if I'm wrong, because this is far from my expertise, you're supposed to maintain, like, fighting shape or be relatively ready to go within a short notice?
I mean, maybe, but I ignored all that because I was done.
Like I said, 6 years of submarines, I'm fine. I did my service.
Actually, at the out meetings when they were, like, telling us, like, how to transition to civilian life, and the guy was trying to say, like, yeah, if they call you back, you have to show up and you have to do this. And I raised my hand. I said, what if I say no? I think I blew the guy's mind because he was like, yeah, I can do that now. I'm a civilian.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like what being a colonialist was like back then if you were in the military. Yeah, I mean, and here's the thing. There's a big gradient of what military service looked like in this time frame. Like, the idea of a professional standing army, especially in the United States, like, that's really a product of kind of post-war of 1812, but really not until the Civil War. Then we fought the idea of a standing professional military all the way up to World War II.
Yeah.
When World War I started, the U.S. had a military that was about the size of Portugal's military.
No kidding.
So in 100 years, we went from the 19th, 20th, 21st, that range, largest military, to the absolute unstoppable force that exists today. Like, we went from no power projection to blinding light of projection of power in 100 years. We kind of, like, World War II ended, and we were like, no, we're not doing this again. And that's what the Brits' strategy was, too, at this time frame. Like, we didn't see additional parity to the Brits until post-Revolutionary War, really, until... Yeah, we didn't really see it until the Napoleonic Wars. And it wasn't necessarily...
By parity? Like, our forces could match theirs, you mean?
Yeah, I'm counting the U.S. I'm counting early George Washington's life as him still being a British citizen. Is that the Brits basically said, we're going to have the most dominant navy on Earth.
Yep.
And if you want to attack us, you have to come here.
Yeah.
And we're going to have the most dominant navy on Earth, and you're going to have to come to us, which isn't really too far from what the U.S. does now.
Yeah, just on a bigger scale.
Yeah. Kyle, I'm very curious about how you'd get called back up, given what your job was. Like, what war is breaking out? They're like, we need more nuclear. We need more boomer stuff.
If that happens, then I'm probably not worried.
Yeah. It's future. A win-win for you.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, you know what? I'm just going to go watch the sunrise.
The multiple suns rise?
Yeah.
So, that's probably very appealing to, if you think of somebody like George Washington, like somebody who grew up, you know, in Virginia on a small plantation and then ended up having, you know, his father passed away. The historical record's a little loose on how Washington was with his stepfather. It doesn't seem like there's anything horrible that historians really make of note, but still probably horrible for a kid, right? That's not a... Dude, people are still people, right? I don't care if it's 1730.
In the 1700s, I'd imagine it'd be even worse.
Right? Like... Because you're so reliant on your father.
Right. Plus all the inheritances and everything that you're probably not going to get because he's going to care more about his firstborn.
Yeah. So he didn't have this like easy childhood. He wasn't the way a king was brought up. I mean, I don't think if you asked George Washington, he was 20 or 30 years old. What do you think you're going to be in? How do you think your legacy is going to be remembered? Do you think this will be a state named after you? Like a state in a D.C.? Like,
right.
That, you know, it is fascinating to think these were people. These were actual people. So he joins the military. He has this allure of climbing the ranks and this meritocratic view of I'm going to become, this gentleman officer and that's going to be my life, yada, yada, all that stuff. Obviously, life doesn't go to plan, right? So even though he had limited formal education, he ends up becoming a surveyor, which back in that day, being the surveyor for your local community was a huge deal. Mm-hmm. They had huge economic influence. And they had to be honest, right? There was a lot of surveyors, not just in the United States, or what would become the United States, not just in Britain, all over the world, who exploited their roles. They took bribes. They, you know, measured wrong to take advantage of things. They had knowledge of land deals coming up and were trying to exploit that for their own gain. Washington was notoriously straight-laced. Like, almost comically straight-laced.
I cannot tell a lie, the cherry tree story, it actually has kind of representative of his values.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think he cut down a cherry tree. By the way, I don't know who lets a little kid play with axes. That was also always a weird part of the story.
1740s, dude. 1740s.
Good counterpoint, Kyle. I will retreat on that one. He was a super, super honest guy. And it's very funny because I think nowadays, I mean, anybody who's bought a house had hired a surveyor. We view it as the most like mundane thing in the world. Like you're just, you hired this professional to do it. The idea that your surveyor is like part of surveyors are part of the local government. Like the idea that your surveyor would be like a judge is so bizarre to us today that we don't realize like, George Washington was a surveyor. Like he was a surveyor. Yeah, like that was a huge deal. and he practiced it honestly, and he was, and this is a time frame where there was no jurisdiction. It's not like there was a court you could appeal to say like, oh, I think Washington measured my land wrong. So yeah, so he goes through surveying, goes to the military, and after the French and Indian War, or the Seven Years' War ended, I would make an argument the Seven Years' War is the first world war. It was fought.
It's fought here against the Indians with the French involved, right?
Mm. Yep. It was, there's some fighting in the Philippines, there's fighting in Europe. Like, you know, it really consumed the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
And the order that was left afterwards is that it wasn't that French, the French were subdued in North America. I think sometimes that gets taught that way in school. And I think they just do that to make a little nice little closed ending. Like, French and Indian War ended.
Right.
It's like, nah, there was still a lot of frontier pressure. We wouldn't see that, really reside for almost 150 years after the French and Indian War. But it largely, from a French standpoint, what it really did is the New World became more of just an economic vessel than anything else. And on this, throughout George Washington, we're going to talk a lot about like the economics of land and some of the funny stories like Georgia selling Alabama. Like, that was just a thing that happened under, Oh, yeah, I know. We'll get into that. I don't want to give too much away. But, like, yeah, Georgia, just, like, a bunch of Georgia politicians in, like, the 1780s and 90s. And, you know, I think it was well into Washington's presidency. Like, just started selling land in Alabama, which is part of Georgia at the time, to themselves.
To themselves?
Yeah, for, like, nothing.
Oh, wow.
It was a huge controversy. And, like, we just, like, never talk about it in school or anything like that. It's very bizarre. I'm like, are we just not going to talk about the time Georgia tried to sell Alabama to Georgians? And that's why we have the SEC. The football conference, not the regulatory body.
Yeah.
No, so,
I'm adding that to their the part four agenda, because I do want to get back into that.
What, the SEC?
Alabama selling Georgia.
Oh, yeah. No, I have a whole section on that. Oh, see, Mr. Mr. Kyle, you need to be careful when I do homework on stuff, because I am an insane human being, and I will...
Well, I've been told I'm not allowed to look at your notes, so...
Yes! Oh, for everybody on the show, just to let you know, Kyle is not allowed to see any of my notes. He is not allowed to ask me any prior questions. I want him to be as traumatized as everybody else. If I had to be traumatized, Kyle, you also have to be traumatized, my dear friend. Yeah, so kind of ending Mr. Washington's earlier life. So he ends up marrying Martha, who's a divorcee. She has a ton of land. She does have a lot of slaves, and she's very prominent. So he transitions.
Just go back to that real quick with Martha. Was there anything, the indication of that was more for status, that relationship, or was there more to it?
Yeah. So this is a good question. Because
a divorcee is kind of that's not normal in 1700s, I wouldn't think, right?
No.
There's probably a stigma associated with even being seen with someone like that.
Yes. So I want to correct myself real quick. I use the term divorcee. All right.
Mm-hmm.
There's a cloudiness. A lot of this history is a little cloudy. So anybody listen to this, if you go and fact check some of the stuff, the data side of it, you know, we're going to probably be like right on, because we're probably gonna be pulling from the same source. Martha Washington, I know her husband predeceased her.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they were still married prior to that being...
So she may deceased. Have been a widower.
She may have been, a widow. A lot of not immediately from the 1700s, but shortly after there. I have read the word divorcee more than a few times. And usually if you're using that word, just like you said, Kyle, at this time period, you're using that because it's so unique to that time period.
Right. Because you think that if it was the other way, if her husband died while they were still married, if the husband had any siblings, isn't that typically the tradition, was the brother would marry the wife and then take care of the family for the deceased brother?
Yeah, that was very, very, I know that was popular in Europe. With how people kind of came over to the New World, they usually come over all as family. So I think that trend, I don't know if that tradition was as alive in Virginia at the time, but you're certainly right. It was contemporary to that time period.
Yeah.
And I believe it lasted in some parts of the world. Actually, in some parts of the world, it probably still goes to today.
Yeah, it might still be happening.
But yeah, so you asked a question about the status. And status is always something that was important. And people talk about Washington being kind of obsessed with status. Not obsessed, but it comes off more than it really should be.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't. He was somebody who humbly served with some of the smartest men, who went to some of the most prestigious colleges in the world, And this man didn't have education. He left school when he was 11. He never had any formal education beyond 11. He wasn't this ego-obsessed guy. If he was, he would not
have stepped down, would he?
Right. Yeah. I mean, sometimes the proof's just in the pudding. He was offered to, like, just keep running. He was like, I'm good.
Yep, I'm done.
I'm fine. Like, oh, what an ego-driven guy. No, he had the chance to be king of his own country, and he was like, I'm good.
Unless he knew that's what was going to cement his legacy.
Oh, dude, right? Yeah, but I... the grand scheme.
Right.
My new favorite conspiracy, Kyle. So, as he gets older, you know, he marries Martha. His status goes up a lot, but his status wasn't necessarily seen as... Their status wasn't necessarily seen as his status.
Yeah.
Because a lot of it's derived from Martha. They had a very loving marriage from everything that I could possibly find on this. And I actually have a very good friend who I called who teaches history at I don't want to say the university because it's a very good university and he should not have be associated with my goofiness.
It's not on your shirt, is it?
No, it's not. Okay, yes, I'm sure I'm wearing West Virginia shirt. My apologies for that. It is a New England university. All right. And he basically said, there's always a good story about, married for money and stuff like that. He's like, nah, he loved her. He goes, you look at everything we have on here. They had a great relationship. He goes, no marriage is perfect, but he goes to say that it was a marriage of convenience.
That sounds like a disservice from what he's saying.
Yeah. And he said it's also, people want to make it out to make it sound like he was just like a royal they would see over in Europe. Like, oh, he's marrying for... He wasn't even close to the presidency at the time. He didn't know what his life was going to be. What are you talking, marrying for position?
Right.
So he turns into this gentleman farmer, which, you know, we all... real quick, like, just that term gentleman farmer will pop up a lot in the first, let's say, 5 or 6, 7 presidents. Mm-hmm. That just means you're somebody who got just enough land where you can have leisure activities, but you still need to manage the land.
Mm.
So think of it like you're a small business. You're running a successful small business. Like, you're still working your butt off.
It's like a poor Renaissance man.
Poor Renaissance. I like that guy.
Like, you don't have the time to study everything you want. You still have some work to do, but you have some leisure time to study some things.
Yeah, exactly. Kyle, I like that a lot. That's actually a good one. So he mostly grew tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, the tobacco markets hadn't really stabilized. And if you look at, see, this is where I have a lot of fun, because obviously I'm an economist. But, yeah, so he really, it was a struggle. Like, they would incur debts. It was not an easy time. It's not like he had this infinite, you know, prosperity once he married Martha. No, it was quite the opposite. It was an unstable time period. They had to deal with, you know.
Is piracy a big issue, too?
Yeah, they had piracy during this time period, too. So one of the issues you have is... You're growing tobacco, right? Tobacco is a commoditized crop. Mm-hmm. I'm a big cigar smoker. I love cigars. I don't smoke a lot of cigars because they're still cigars, but I'm behind my green screen is a big humidor.
Wait, that's a green screen?
Yes, I actually don't have the portrait of Cromwell surrendering to Washington in my house. That would be dope. That would be the coolest thing I own. Yeah, but it's very funny because... Yeah, they were dealing with a lot during this time period. You had this destabilization effect because you had growing the slave trade had heated up so much at this time point in the Caribbean. And you saw this mass production of things like, you saw tobacco, sugar cane, indigo, but indigo was more in the southern part of the United States, like think of North Carolina, South Carolina. So as he's trying to compete and have a farm and compete with these prices, he was competing against a different type of economic system. And I know what's going to be said here. George Washington used slaves to harvest tobacco. Barbados and other Caribbean nations on there, they also used slaves. So how are the economics different? And what it comes down to is there were two types of an awful system. In the United States, slavery was practiced on what's called task slavery, which is when you assign, one specific thing for the enslaved individual to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we have stories of enslaved individuals buying their freedom. It's because, I'm not saying this is uniform, I'm not saying this is how it happened everywhere all the time. I'm saying, generally speaking, with task-based slavery, is that once you completed your tasks, you could then, maybe have your own private garden. You could have your own, you could have your own enterprise. And there are stories of slaves selling their goods, saving up money, and buying them and themselves and their families out of slavery. That did not happen in the Caribbean. Caribbean was chain slavery. They worked enslaved people to death. They were tied together. They were fed salted cod. And it was cheaper to import more human lives than to simply treat them well enough that they wake up the next day. Horrific. Yeah. The country of Barbados, which is about the size of Maine, imported the same percentage of slaves from Africa as the entire United States did over the course of the slave trade until 1808.
Jesus. Who ran Barbados?
I'm not actually super sure about that. I believe it was the Spanish, but hold on. We can fact check this. Oh, never mind. It was a British colony.
Oh.
Mm. Huh. I don't... It was originally Portuguese claimed the name, then Spain did. Spain.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think that's Barbados, one of those ones that changed hands a few times, didn't it?
Yeah, the Barbados is run as a British colony from 1625 to 1996. What? Oh, sorry, 1966? I was going to say, that's way too late. Teaching people about... I should have probably prepped for Barbados. That was not my...
I don't think that was the question you thought I would fling at you. That was the thing I was going to question.
You're like, get out, Eric. Yeah, so to kind of finish off his early life, he comes back, so he goes through war, gets his great reputation as a trustworthy surveyor and, public official. He marries Martha Washington, runs this farm, has more success than he had growing up, had more wealth than he probably ever thought he was going to grow up. But his goals, he wanted to be, and this is a story that's similar for many of the founding fathers, he wanted to be a good British citizen.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to be somebody who supported, what he thought was his country. But his country didn't feel that way. We call this term salutary neglect. It's the idea that you have a colony that you just ignore.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't give them representation. You don't give them the ability. You just extract taxes and dollars. But America was weird. We were probably the only colony, large colony. I mean, there was little spot colonies, I'm sure, like Monaco and stuff like that would be an example of. But we were a large, contemporary-sized nation, at least landmass-wise, certainly not population-wise.
Well bigger than most European countries at that time.
Oh, yeah, we had to be, right? Yeah.
Yeah, probably the size of Europe, I would think, or close to.
Yeah, but we were wealthier. We were wealthier, we were happier, we were healthier, and we had no say in our form of government. Now, we had the concept of states. Those states basically come from the individual charters that were issued. So we had kind of self-governance, and this worked great for decades. This worked great for a long time, because the Brits would just tax us. They controlled the seas. We were the same country. We were countrymen. We're like, this is amazing for trade. Boston was the largest port in the entire world in terms of commerce flowing through it. Which is crazy. Boston has 500,000 people today. It's not a big city. Like, I can see Boston from my house. It's not big. It's not New York.
Right.
New York has 16 times as many people as Boston does. And you see all this wealth start gathering and gathering and gathering. And then you have the you have the French and Indian War, 7 years war, and it costs a ton of money. And the Brits were like, hey, real quick, you guys are benefiting a ton from all this naval protection we're giving you.
Yeah.
And you have way more money than us, and we just fought a war to protect your interest on your... Nobody was invading England during the war, the 7 years war. Can you pay some taxes for us? And we were like,
no.
No, but can we have some representation? And they were like, no, dude, we want to keep everything the same. We just want you to pay for all the money we spent defending your Western lands. And we were like, cool, but if you say we're part of your country, how come this entire continent has no members in any form of your government? Right. Like, can you meet us halfway? And that kind of seeds the, starts sowing the seeds for the rise of Washington. Mm-hmm. Like, they were looking for somebody. He was a huge man for the time. He was 6'2". He was built broad shoulders. Like, he was a big man. Not only was he a big man, he was known to have an incredible presence. He was known to be slightly awkward, charismatic type. But intelligent, good listener, all these things that made him appealing to have in a room. And he was from Virginia. He was from one of the most wealthiest populated states in the middle, colonies in the middle. He harbored both national views and state views. And he kind of became the exact man needed for that moment. And we're going to continue to follow the rise of Washington, becoming the father of this country. But we're going to do that next week. So you got to subscribe. You got to stay tuned. We're going to leave you on a little bit of a cliffhanger.
Yeah, so it probably is a good place to call it for part one. So as Eric said, join us next week. We'll start picking apart the policies that define Washington's presidential terms. But in the meantime, we do want to hear from you. So what do you make of Washington's character? Do you think he was a status hog, or do you think he married for love? You know, email us at chinashopproductions@gmail.com. You can also visit the website, thebuckstartsherepodcast.com, if you want to stay up to date. We'll see you all next week.